It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In the wake of the Miami Dolphins suspension of veteran guard Richie Incognito for allegedly sending threatening messages, including racial slurs, to a younger teammate, what does the average fan really know about the NFL's culture of hazing? What can or should the NFL do about it? I'm joined now in studio by our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus, Bob Dvorak. Check out his video blog, Sportsnet. Good day, Bob.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Apparently, there is a history of hazing in the NFL. How far back does it go?
I'd say 1920, when the NFL was established. This stuff has gone on forever in one way or another. And, you know, some hazing is just part of team building and competitive men sharing a room. Sometimes when it's an egregious example, it makes the news, like this case in Miami, which seems to be a very egregious example of going over the line.
Right. It certainly seems to stand out. But would it have stood out years ago? Would we have even heard about it years ago? Would anybody have cared in the way that they do today?
I would say that there are a lot of examples probably that you never hear about, because the code in the NFL, in the NHL, and Major League Baseball is what happens in the clubhouse stays in the clubhouse. So I'm sure there had been examples that we never heard of. This one happened to make the news, and I think it made the news because it did cross the line.
In the past, generally, what form has hazing taken?
Well, if you're talking about hazing, every rookie that comes into an NFL camp might at some point have to stand up and sing his college alma mater as a form of, hey, rookie, welcome to the NFL. You know, is that hazing? Is that a form of, or is that a ritual of, you know, you're on the team now, but you're a mere rookie. You have to adhere to our culture in the clubhouse. In the NHL, there are rookies who are made to buy a meal for their teammates, take them out for dinner, which has happened in Major League Baseball. And usually when they played in Montreal, because you had to come through customs, the veterans would steal the clothes of a rookie and put a costume in the locker, maybe a Cinderella dress or something of that nature, and the rookie would have to wear that home on the team plane and go through customs in Montreal. It seems kind of silly, seems kind of almost fun. People get a kick out of it, and then they move on.
Right. Now, what we're hearing about in Miami is something far more serious, where a rookie was made to cough up money to pay for the trips of other teammates to Las Vegas. Have you heard of anything like this?
No, other than the fact, you know, you might have to buy a meal for your teammates and they'll order the most expensive items. Okay, but, you know, they make a ton of money, so what? I hadn't heard anything as bad as this, but again, the alleged person who did all this had a history. So there were some warning signs way ahead of time. Maybe they should have known ahead of time that something like this was possible.
Have the Steelers players ever engaged in this kind of hazing? What have you heard? You've covered them in the past. What do you know about what's going on in their locker room?
Well, the rookies do have to sing the alma mater at lunch, although that's
harmless stuff.
Yeah, right. For example, I just heard this story from Rocky Blyer, the glory days of the Steelers in the 70s. Everybody nowadays has their own headphones and music box. There's no problem. In the old days, they had a community radio sound system, and Terry Bradshaw liked country music. Some of the other players liked soul music. So they would play with the dial, and you'd change the dial, and somebody would change it back, and it got to be maybe an issue. Joe Green solved it by cutting the extension cord so that nobody listened to anything. And that's what a team leader would do. If there's a potential for something happening that, hey, you know, might distract from what they're trying to really accomplish, which is to win, you just eliminate the threat.
But did we ever hear about out-and-out cruelty of the nature that we're hearing about now, back in the old days?
No, and I think this might be such a egregious case that I don't know that ever rose to this level before. And you know, there's a fine line between, you know, welcoming teammates through rituals and the clubhouse culture that you have to fit in, and then doing something of this nature where a teammate actually has to leave the team and the alleged perpetrator is now in counseling.
We're talking with our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus. Does the NFL, Bob, or any of the individual teams have any rules on the books establishing a clear line when it comes to hazing that players know cannot be crossed?
The one thing the NFL hates more than anything else is bad publicity. It does have policies governing clubhouse behavior. The Players Association, as part of the collective bargaining agreement, has policies about this in place. And I think some of those policies were triggered in this particular case that helped bring it to light. Especially, I think an agent reported it. So there are rules, standards that you have to live by. Whether how it crosses the line and who reports it is really the issue. But this has gone on forever. It's just part of the culture of men together, competitive men together in a clubhouse, establishing their own rules as boys will be boys.
Who's responsible for dealing with this?
Well, first of all, it's an individual issue, so it should be handled individually. There are team captains. There are clubhouse leaders. They'll see things and put a stop to something that they think is going over the top. The manager of a club, the coach of a club, the person in charge of the organization certainly are in charge, too. But that's an issue that players have to take almost to the coach. Coaches are like us. They don't spend a whole lot of time in the locker room environment. Even beat writers spend maybe an hour and a half a day in the clubhouse. You really don't know what's going on all the time. You just get a window into what might be happening.
So is it about changing the culture? And if so, how do you do that? Because we're hearing more and more about violence, particularly off the field, involving NFL players who are committing crimes. And this may not necessarily – we don't know if any laws were broken here, but clearly this goes into the area of bullying, which most teams nowadays would not want to see.
And absolutely. And don't forget, the NFL, all sports clubhouses and cultures are microcosms of society. Bullying goes on in the general population, correct? It goes on in clubhouses, and you have to stand up for yourself. That's the way you fit into these things. The way to address it is when a player is drafted, and they get all these guys together now, before they join an NFL team, after they leave college and before they join a team, is to spell out these rules and to say, look, this is not going to be tolerated. So if you participate in this kind of behavior, you're going to be subject to some discipline.
Earlier this season, the Deseret News in Utah reported that the head coach of the Union High School football team in Roosevelt, Utah, suspended all 80 players from the team due to reports of bullying and academic issues. Is this how you change the culture from one where bullying is acceptable?
It's a positive first step. Good on the coach. I mean, he saw a situation and stepped in and said, I'm not going to tolerate this. And I'm sure not everybody on that team participated, and some innocent people were disciplined at the same time. But if it got out of hand and he wanted to control it and stop it, this is what he did. So that is certainly one positive first step to take.
Here in Western Pennsylvania, which is a hotbed for high school football, if a coach did that, especially if the team was winning, how would the parents and the community react? Granted, it varies from community to community, but would something like that go over here?
I think there would be a mixed reaction, but I would hope that people would see the benefit of such a decision, that it's for a general common good. You know, if you have to suspend play, if you have to say, look, we're not going to do this until everybody gets on board, I would think that they would embrace it and say, yes, let's correct this because we want to do it the right way.
So the high school football experience, and maybe at other levels, can be about learning to be a good person and a responsible citizen as well as a football player.
Well, that's the theory about sports in general, isn't it? It teaches character, it teaches camaraderie and bonding and things of that sort. And I will say, in this day and age, and I hardly recognize the culture anymore, kids start playing football at 8 years old and they're pouring Gatorade on the coach at a championship game. Have we lost our priorities as a society? It's time to take a good hard look at this. There's no harm in examining these things and saying, look, if we're going to operate, it's not about just sports and games. It's about your character and where you fit into society as a whole.
Before we let you go, Bob, we want to congratulate you on being, since we last spoke, being inducted into the Uniontown High School Sports Hall of Fame. No small accomplishment that, because there are some luminaries that you have been enshrined with. Congratulations.
It was an incredible, humbling honor, and I was just so happy to share it with as many family members and friends as I could.
Congratulations again, Bob.
Thank you.
Bob Dvorak is our sports guy. He is a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus, and he has a video blog that you can check out called Sportsnet. Again, thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Paul.